Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Oklahoma and the entire nation has benefited from the shale revolution in oil and gas recovery. Today, the U.S. is at a 25-year high in oil production and is the world's leading producer of natural gas. What does this changing energy landscape mean for the U.S. on the political stage? Well, my guest today is uniquely qualified to answer that question from a variety of perspectives, because a variety of perspectives has defined his career. My guest today is James Clad, today a senior advisor at the Center for Naval Analysis and Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Native of New Zealand, he served in the New Zealand Diplomatic Service, later wrote for the Far Eastern Economic Review, and had fellowships at Oxford and at Harvard's Center for International Affairs. He then later joined the U.S. Department of Defense from 2002 to 2010. He served as the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia. He's the author of several books, Business, Money, and Power in Southeast Asia, After the Crusade, which critiqued U.S. foreign policy. His most recent book is a volume on political geography, The Borderlands of Southeast Asia. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, and I spoke with him while he was here. James Clad, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
You've said that the new techniques in hydraulic fracturing and unconventional oil and gas recovery are going to really provide North America, we should remember it's North America, not just the U.S., with some great advantages over the next few years. Economically, could expand to politics, but certainly stable supplies and the idea of no energy shocks over the next few years. There's going to be some advantages. Give us a sense of the scope and scale of those advantages.
Yeah, well, I think, Rich, the first thing to do is to say, you know, one always has to take one's pulse when you start looking into the future. And then anything that seems to be proceeding well anywhere, anytime, always has more than its usual army of boosters who are going to get behind it and say this is the best thing forever. And we've got to be careful that we don't overhype what the changes are. There's still a number of profound structural problems in our country that are going to need more than just a comparatively rapid uptick in the availability of energy resources. But if you put that kind of qualifying thought to one side for a moment, I think what you've got to accept is that we're in a position of energy abundance. You know, you say it and you think, wait a minute, has he got this right? Energy abundance? This is the U.S. of A. We've been held to ransom, you know, by Arab sheikhs withholding gasoline nozzles, you know, for the last 30-something years. But the truth is, we are. And it's happened as a result of convergence of technologies that each of which individually and severally were in use before, but about the middle of the last decade came into play. And by the way, there's a fourth element. Let's just go through them very quickly. There's horizontal drilling. There's microseismic surveying techniques and computerization enabling a lot of things to be done for far less cost. And then horizontal drilling. So what did I say? Horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing, and microseismic. And then the fourth issue, of course, people who don't like the government never like to hear this one mentioned, government support in terms of policies favoring it from DOE, Department of Energy, tax breaks, credits, research and development incentives. I mean, the government was part of this. And so it came to play about 2006, 2007. There was a dramatic increase. And what we're looking at now is a situation where Texas, for example, outproduces in oil and gas Iran, or North Dakota produces more oil and gas than the bottom three members of OPEC. I mean, this is really hard, even though the facts are now out there for a couple of years, to wrap our minds around. So those changes have big consequences, you just mentioned, and they are economic and they relate to our country's position in the world, and that's why I became interested in this stuff.
How did you get interested in this? Because I know your background is defense matters. You were a journalist. You've been a diplomat for two different countries, New Zealand as well as the United States. But how did you get interested in the energy issues? Does it come out of your time at the Defense Department?
Well, it actually comes out when I was a very, very young diplomat for New Zealand, and New Zealand was installing the first geothermal power station in all of Southeast Asia. So I began to become acquainted with all these roughnecks. And if you drill for geothermal steam, it's pretty much the same as if you're drilling for other things as well. And it became part of a range of interests. And then there's a very famous energy analyst by the name of Dan Yergin. I think you've had him on your program. And Dan had met me when I was at Harvard for a year, and he said, why don't you come into my company? So while I was a professor at Georgetown, I was able to keep body and soul together by doing some consulting work for Dan, and it just stayed in place. Of course, I had to put that to one side when I went into the Defense Department to work for Robert Gates. But it always struck me as the perfect way to look at trends politically, to look at influence and to study markets in a business where the people in charge, unlike people who sit in think tanks in Washington, have to take responsibility for what they forecast and expect to come down the next quarter or two. So it's a fascinating business that mixes the political side, the 30,000-foot side, and the close-in stuff that I hear when I go out and talk like this, and I meet people who are geology, you know, specialist geologists, wellhead engineers, and they'll tell you things about some of the prospectivity of these enormous areas of potential, and you realize that we're really sitting on something that's qualitatively different and bigger.
And from everything you're hearing, is there nothing but optimism in the oil patch?
Well, remember, optimism results from many different causes. One of the sources of optimism, I think, is the way in which companies, whether they're small or large, have been able to reach enormous increases in efficiency of operations in a very short time. There's a company in Arkansas, I can't remember the name of it for the moment, but in 1 year, it was taking 22 days from the spudding in, you know, the initial drilling of a well, to production. It's now down to 3 days.
Wow.
I mean, you think of what that means. So while the number of rigs that are now engaged in drilling that will be, you know, and drilling's different from the actual hydraulic fracturing part, that are engaged in that activity has shrunk by about 50% from about like 2010. The productivity per well is immensely increasing. And that's one of the things you were asking about optimism that makes me think, well, wow, even if, say, world oil prices reached, you know, $80, $75 a barrel, it seems that we'll still be in the game via this big new change.
Right. And this is the other big question, though. Will this unconventional oil and gas recovery techniques, will they be able to outpace world demand? Because world demand tends to lessen when that price gets to $120, $130 a barrel, but when it gets back down to whatever level it settles at, there's again this push for demand. And then we're certainly seeing it in India and China.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be in the middle class.
2 billion people.
And what's the symbol that you've arrived in the middle class? Is a motor car of some description and roads that have to be widened and all the rest of it. Yeah, even in our country, of oil that's consumed, over 70% of it's related to the transportation sector. But there, you know, again, you're asking some interesting questions. How long have we heard the good news that the gas was going to be liquefied, or there'll be a way in which natural gas can be burned as a fuel in the long-haul transport fleet? You know, each time we seem to get close to it, and yet the residual inertia of all that investment in the trucks as they're now built, as they're the fuel they now use, gets in the way. But I've talked to people who are like really sensible and really skeptical about a lot of things, and they say the economics now unquestionably favor a shift in the long-haul transport fleet, and you're seeing some companies that are in the business really beginning to change. And when that changes, that's going to make a big difference in oil demand in this country.
So when you're talking about long-haul, you're talking about trucking, the trucking industry going to LNG.
That's right.
Here in Oklahoma, there's a lot of people who like to do the conversion for their cars as well. Do you think that will come along? Or, you know, the whole thing is every time the oil price stabilizes, a lot of these efforts sort of go, oh, well, we'll get used to paying it here in Oklahoma, which is envious to most of the rest of the country, $3.50 a gallon for gas.
$3.50. I'm moving here tomorrow. $3.50. Sure. I just bought, at the urging of my wife, if she should ever hear this program, a Land Rover LR4 V8. And every time I put the petrol pedal down, I see the fuel gauge go down too. So I'm moving here in a hurry, but I take your point. Yes, and we're a big enough country to be able to have some of these regional changes made without having some kind of one-size-fits-all edict across the country. But it seems to me that that's still hard to envisage because, again, of the thing I mentioned earlier, the inertia of dealerships, the inertia of the existing infrastructure and of gasoline stations and the refinery setup and all the rest of it. You don't make these changes overnight. That's why I tend to think that the hybridization of the light transport fleet, like utility vans and things that are going around inside the city, and then these long-haul trucks, that has been described to people by people who know a lot more than I do about it as a really significant tipping point.
Since we're talking in this direction, I have to ask you about like a pure electric company that's making cars. I'll mention it, Tesla. You know, Tesla is building out this whole network of rapid refueling stations, electric refueling stations, a lot of them powered, at least in the Southwest, by solar power. They're going ahead with this network. I think you can go on an electric car from Los Angeles to New York via these stopping stations. Do you see that as long-term viable?
Or is it
just well ahead of the game?
Well, look at the average income earned by a Tesla buyer.
Yes, of course, you're talking about buying a house to buy a car.
Well, pretty much, but the point is that we were a big country and certainly rich at the top end, able to afford it. And also, it's a constantly innovating company. From what I hear, Tesla didn't come out with an erector set that said, well, here it is, and that's the one thing you can use, and that's the way it's going to be. They seem to be very open to those changes. But it's the baseline infrastructure, whether you power up at home or nearby. People like to do things at home in the U.S. How do you actually do it? How do you get the transformers and everything in? It's not easy. But on the other hand, who would have thought that there'd be a Tesla out there doing these things? I mean, I tend to be one of these people with a fixed smile on my face all the time, because if I see a new innovation, I think, that's good. That isn't going to displace anything. Just as I think that the hydraulic fracturing thing, which excites the dismay and skepticism of many people I know, including my sister, who used to work for Al Gore in Nashville, I can tell you that it's always a question of seeing it, as the British say, in the round. See it in toto and realize that it's not a static technology. There's no question but it has the potential to be toxic. Who could pretend otherwise, right? But there's no question also that the companies themselves, not wishing to try to save, and the cost of recycling and remediating is the fancy word, the water that they use in this hydraulic fracturing, are looking at other ways to do the same thing. They've got propane pellets, which they punch in, achieve the same pressurizing effect on the shale, get the oil, get the gas extracted out, and conveniently these little pellets merged with the gas that they're extracting out, and nothing's left behind. Hmm. And it doesn't have this, you know, alleged impact on causing tremors that some high-pressure water injected into some of these sedimentary levels do. So you see what I'm saying? I mean, I'm tearing away here, throwing facts at you like a fiend. But the main thing is it's innovative, and it's really changing just as we speak. If you can have a company, as I said to you earlier, that can achieve from 22 days required to get a productive well underway in Arkansas to 3 days, and they achieve that in the space of 12 months, then you're looking at some people who are really continuing to innovate. Seems to me it's got to be something that's going to be with us for a long time.
I want to talk about the idea that we'll be exporting, whether it's oil or natural gas, especially LNG, to other places in the world. A lot of people look at the Keystone XL pipeline, which is pretty popular for the most part around this part of the country, although not with environmentalists. But I also hear what you're saying about all these changes. And you look at what the originating process is a horribly filthy product in Alberta, which is the tar sands, and it's using tons of water. It's using tons of natural resources. Does that still remain viable, given all the new technologies that are coming out, which, you know, is less dirty?
Price is king. Right. Price of $120 a barrel arguably gave the big impetus in the middle of the last decade to see the type of things that we've seeing, and then augmented and surviving even with a price drop. Went down to $2 MBTU, millions
gas,
of British thermal units. Gas, well, it's back up to over four, and yet they still managed to survive. Now, some of it, they were captive. They were captive to their own ambitions, long-term contracts, and all the rest of it. A lot of people, were very happy and would have gotten out of the business sooner, but they were stuck. That's the nature of the overall impact of the market. The demand abroad, it seems to me, when the Chinese, whose economy is slowing, really have to answer to the rage of the people who must breathe that filth every day in Beijing and many of the other industrialized cities, Wuhan and many others, when they do what the Japanese and the Koreans did long ago in the 1970s, which is what? To
get out of the
coal and import LNG, and they did it as a political thing as well as for efficiency of combustion and all those other reasons that natural gas is a good thing. If the Chinese follow that road, then the demand for natural gas is going to be huge. I gave a talk in Beverly Hills. It's a very interesting place to give a talk. It's different from other places. You know, I'd been in Casper a couple of weeks before, and there I was in Beverly Hills, and a well-dressed gentleman stood up in the back, and he said, I'm the consul of the People's Republic of China. I said, I'm glad you're here. And he said, do you think the Americans will put any conditions on the sale of LNG to China as opposed to selling to any other Asian market? And I have to say, in the face of some of kind of assertive and irritating Chinese diplomacy, I did like leaving him with the idea that we might actually do something, even though I can't see any of our exporters being happy about that for a moment. But the point is that the gas market is going to continue to be high, and it's driven by something which strikes me as pretty much an unalloyed good. And I know people in the coal industry who've been trying their darndest to get clean coal out there at a competitive level, but it just doesn't seem to be happening. And so we are, in this country, the latest stats suggest there's 122 coal-fired power stations which are going to be retired, that's the verb, in less than 2 years, with pulling out 80 gigawatts of generating potential, replacing it almost entirely with natural gas using the latest generation of combined cycle turbines, which are produced very well in this country, one of the remaining areas of our industrial strength. So isn't that a good thing? So when I begin to look at it, reduction of coal, the carbon footprint of this country has gone down by something like 7 or 8% since 2010. That seems to be almost entirely a result of the retirement of coal-fired power stations and bringing in natural gas, which is far cleaner fuel. And then you look at the fact that the impact it's having on American manufacturing. It isn't, again, some beautiful panacea. Like the steel industry has been supplying pipe and getting much cheaper power. It gives them a bit of a breather. But now the Chinese are dumping excess piping in our markets, and so there we are again, stuck with some of the downside consequences of globalization. I'm not speaking against globalization, but I'm just saying you got to expect that maybe if we are really interested in the steel industry surviving this country, we ought to be thinking something about like that. But you see, it's never an unalloyed good. Cement industry uses power very heavily, but it's also a very old-style industry. And so you see, industry by industry, you're looking at changes. You're looking at changes which are generally beneficial. I was on a guy with a guy on an airplane. He does human resource subcontracting to a lot of small and medium businessmen. He started talking about the fact that these companies in turn subcontract to people who are in turn supplying the hydraulic fracturing industry. And you can see the flow through. And it's isn't it a good thing to see after years of feeling like we've been slipping right across the board?
And you mentioned this Chinese consul general. If China really does get serious about retiring their coal power, that's an enormous market.
Think of it. Well, just think of the industrial advantage which this natural gas gives to American firms. Look at the differential between the U.S. and, say, Germany. It's 1 to 3.5. So 3.5 times more expensive in Europe. And then look at the differential between us and the price of natural gas here. This is averaged out, of course. And in Northeast Asia, it's in the nature of 1 to 9. I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing. And it's no wonder that, big American chemical companies don't want to see a bit of it exported because they're worried that it'll affect the price and, you know, reduce their competitive advantage. And then you go back to the guys who are looking at the prospectivity, you know, the reservoirs of this stuff. And they say, no, every week seems to bring larger estimates rather than reduced. And so the figure I heard, which sort of really beggars imagination, is that in the United States alone, there's 6,000 trillion cubic feet of this resource available. And by the way, you mentioned Canada. Canada's sitting on some huge shale prospectivity. Forget the oil sands. And by the way, Mexico, right next to Texas, has got a huge reservoir as well. So it does sound like I'm a bit of a Pollyanna, but I just can't see us sliding back into a situation where with prices perhaps falling down, everything falls apart. I just don't see that as happening.
My guest today is James Cladd, a senior advisor for the Center for Naval Analysis and Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the world politics of a changing energy landscape. I want to talk about what's going on in Russia, because a lot of analysts have talked about this, you know, Russia flexing its energy muscles because of its control of a lot of energy exports in that region of the world, vis-a-vis the Ukraine and this sort of reclaiming of the Soviet Union. But I wonder how much of this is really due to positioning on this energy horizon, this coming energy horizon. Do you think there's much going into that?
Well, I think they must be aware of our competitive advantage arising out of hydraulic fracturing and the energy abundance that's been enabled by shale. They're aware that they, unlike the United States, you know, we export a lot still, despite what we've done to much of our industry over the last 15 or 20 years. But the Russians have one thing, which is hydrocarbons. So if the market is now more stabilized because of our production, our added production, then they're aware of that as well. They're also aware that they have a limited time window to move against the Europeans, because once we do start exporting LNG, one of the export destinations will be Europe. That doesn't mean that we can make up the shortfall, but then Europe isn't entirely dependent on Russian oil and gas anyway. So it's a mixed picture. I think that, you know, and this may run slightly counter to some of your listeners' views, I think that we're paying something of a price, an unexpected price, for an attitude which set in really quickly after the end of the Cold War, which was that the Russians don't really count. They're not really players. That we can extend the, or that the European Union can be extended, that NATO can be extended, and that it went wider and wider out, but it was very shallow-rooted. And so, the you know, for us, the Ukraine, you know, to be blunt about it, is, if not marginal, then it's certainly not central. But for Russia, you know, there, whether whatever we think of it, the Ukraine is part of the greater Slavic origin of the Russian state and Muscovy and all of this history that we've got no time to go into now. But to act as if what was going on in the Ukraine shouldn't bother them is really an act of conceit on our part. And I think that we've all been a little bit surprised by the fact that the hitherto docile Russian bear growled back and then took a little bit back what it feels it's been losing across the board ever since 1990. So put it in context. A lot of people say, well, the Russians have run off to the Chinese, and there's this huge oil and gas deal, and they're going to turn their backs on the West, and I don't believe a word of it. I think, firstly, there's an old adage that in China, you sign the contract, and then you start negotiating. Believe me, many people who are sadder but wiser as a result of understanding that maxim. Secondly, the intended supply is to come from greenfield development, which means, you know, new fields in the Siberian far east of Russia. And if we can reach a political understanding with Moscow, right, and it seems to me that's what we're doing right now, no one's going to go to war to preserve Crimea's integral part of Ukraine. And if we reach a political settlement in the next 5 or 6 months, my guess would be this deal with the Chinese might not look as hard and fast as some of the commentators think it is.
Do you think Russians would prefer to send their oil supplies west rather than east?
Listen, here's a trick question for you. Which end-use market is more likely to apply political conditionality, China or the European Union? Got it?
I believe that would be China.
So, yeah, that's the situation. And the Russians are not particularly enamored of the Chinese. They see demographic pressure going into the Russian Far East. They see a very, very expansionist-minded power, as witnessed by its behavior in the East and the South China Seas. So the Russians aren't asleep to this, and they preserve their options like any great power should.
Hmm. Now, I know a big part of what you're doing is you're advising companies of risks in moving into new places. Where are some of the areas of risk that most people, it's just totally off the radar at this point?
Well, you know, one of the things that people tend to forget in the energy markets is, one, I mean, they're global. So it's nice to have all this energy abundance, but it doesn't necessarily translate into cheaper petroleum prices here at home. It would be a lot more expensive without American abundance, but that's hard to tell people that. It's counterintuitive. You know, it's about the dog that didn't bark. Beyond that, the risks that are out there in the energy market remain the same as they've been for the last 30 or 40 years, which is summed up in the old joke that we know that God has a sense of humor because of where she or he, you know, puts the oil. And it's in places that sort of seem to go very badly wrong very quickly, you know, whether it's Libya, whether it's some problems with the Suez, whether it's Syria, whether it's West Nigeria, whether it's Benin, whether it's Venezuela. I think I've made my point. And traders are an integral part of the system that gets all this stuff to us. But as you're probably aware, they're not averse to taking advantage of a short-term political crisis and driving price up for a bit. That's part of the world as it is, and it's probably likely to remain for a long time. But even there, the risk of that spiking and really creating supply disruptions is reduced because of American supply. If I were to think of risk right now, I think that Chinese behavior in the Western Pacific is so assertive, and I'm using a gentle word, that the risks of something going rather wrong, I mean seriously wrong, are not inconsequential now.
So you're talking not only Taiwan, which is the traditional area where we think things could go wrong, but Japan over those islands that nobody, where no one lives.
Japanese patrolling planes were approached just last week to within 100 feet by Chinese interceptors. The Chinese have more than 120 warships surrounding a rig, a billion-dollar rig, owned by Chinese state petroleum company, towed into contested waters with Vietnam.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about it. Water issues concerning Southeast Asia, where you know the rivers start in China and they flow to Southeast Asia.
I mean, those are long-term, I'd almost call them kind of enduring overhang risk issues. But right now, the things that could cause trouble, and when businessmen think of trouble, they think of disruption. They think of people raising marine, you know, shipping insurance rates two or three or four times. Things like that could come very quickly. So, you know, I've been talking about this, and frankly, I didn't expect to be talking like this a couple months ago. I thought that the Chinese would restrain themselves a bit. So there's one area. I tend to be more optimistic about Ukraine. I think that we will reach an accord with the Russians. We should. We must. The Germans want one especially, but Europe needs it. And then I think beyond that, it's really a question of whether we can somehow preserve the market dynamic of the energy abundance we have now and yet understand, and this is just a personal view, that it really is a, quote, bridging fuel, unquote, which is what the president says. I agree with him.
That's my last question. Even the most optimistic observer would say that this is kicking the can down the road 20, maybe 50 years, the most optimistic estimates. Eventually, we're going to have that day of reckoning with hydrocarbons. What should we be doing now? Even though, you know, it seems like it's off the radar screen, and as soon if prices come down, it'll even be further off. What should we be doing now?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to be really seriously mentally impaired to think that everything's limitless. I mean, it is a small planet. We do have a particular and limited window. The data suggesting melting the Antarctic really does seem to be another thing that says, you know, this isn't a pipe dream. The climate change is huge and it's with us right now. On the other hand, there's something I learned as a schoolboy in New Zealand. It's an old saying that the British say that you should never let the best be enemy of the good, that if we hold out for the optimal, then we lose the chance to make incremental changes, which might give us a bit more time. It seems to me to be an unalloyed good that we have reduced our carbon footprint by burning more efficient fuel. That doesn't mean that we're stopped burning fuels. Of course, there's consequence, and by the way, from methane operations that are linked to hydraulic fracturing. But the overall effect is an abatement of the worst of those tendencies. So it seems to me to be something devoutly to be hoped for, that the Chinese would begin to reduce their rate of adding to coal-fired capacity and maybe even begin to retire some before too long. That seems to give us a bit more of a chance towards a future where renewables become, if not predominant, then an increasingly large part. At the moment, they're about 9 or 10% of American capacity. Even 20 years ago, that would have been seen as huge. The geothermal potential of this country is scarcely developed. It seems to me that if it buys us time, and by the way, it does have a beneficial effect on the revival of our industrial and manufacturing sector, then we're probably in a better place to innovate. There it is. I'm essentially optimistic.
James Clatt, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
James Clatt is a senior advisor for the Center for Naval Analysis, as well as an advisor for the prestigious energy consulting firm, Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa. You can search through our archives or listen to some of our programs on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.